It seemed to me like a book launch could be an invitation to narcissism. So as a way of attempting to avert that temptation, I invited Robin and Glenn and David to speak rather than have me up here pontificating about the book for an hour and a half. However, I also recognize that if I were at a book launch and the author was in attendance and he didn't say anything or she didn't say anything, I would probably go away disappointed. So I felt I probably should say a few words. So I've tried to strike a happy medium here between those two extremes of mounting the lectern and pontificating for an hour and a half or not saying anything at all. So instead, I've come up with this arrangement, which I think was pretty clever, where I'm like the friend who on the day of a big move arrives after his friends have done all of the heavy lifting and arrives just in time to hang the last painting on the wall and then sit down and enjoy the pizza. So I'm going to hang the painting on the wall and then we don't have pizza, but we'll enjoy the refreshments after that. So a few relatively brief comments. First, I have been blessed with the opportunity to work with compelling material. Not only are and were Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas interesting theologians and intellectuals of the highest order, they're also fascinating people. I mean, on the one hand, we have Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is sort of a theological savant. He grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth, and he completed his doctorate at the University of Berlin, one of the most prestigious universities in all of Europe, at the tender age of 21, which is enough to make any other scholar feel inadequate. But not only was he this gifted young prodigy, he also, over the course of his life, learned to see history from below or from the underside. And he was a pastor and theologian who had an uncanny ability or vision or perception, and he immediately recognized Hitler and the Nazis for the threat that they were when many others in the church in Germany did not. Bonhoeffer realized that the only hope for Germany and the world was a church that clung courageously to the confession of the sole lordship of Christ. In this regard, Bonhoeffer was one of few prophetic voices crying in the wilderness in Germany in the 1930s. And he eventually shared in the fate of many prophets when he went to his death on the Nazi gallows in 1945. So we have Bonhoeffer on the one hand. On the other hand, we have Stanley Hauerwas. Probably many of you have heard the name Bonhoeffer, may know a little about him. Probably not as many know Hauerwas, although from the wonderful talks we've had, you're beginning to get a sense of what he's about. Hauerwas is a rough and tumble, sometimes crass and crude, bricklayer from Texas, who, as he describes his own family situation, was the son of hardscrabble, white trash parents from the Deep South. Somehow, he went on to become what Time magazine called America's best theologian. So there's sort of a different trajectory here in Hauerwas's life. And there's also a deep irony in this designation, America's best theologian, as Robin pointed out earlier, and I think Glenn alluded to it as well, that for Hauerwas, perhaps the greatest threat to the salvation of Christians in America is America itself, or at least the confusion of the Christian gospel with the American dream or story. So there is great irony that Hauerwas was named America's best theologian. There's probably also irony that in the same issue, T.D. Jakes was named America's best preacher, but I've never heard Hauerwas mention that. Both Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas possessed voracious intellectual appetites. They read broadly and deeply in everything. Presents a challenge for a scholar who's trying to read them, because you've got to try to have a little bit of familiarity with all of these people they're interacting with, but they're reading philosophers, they're reading sociologists, they're reading literary figures, and of course they're reading theologians and biblical scholars. And this intellectual curiosity is reflected in their own work, which transgresses, often in many ways transgresses, the boundaries drawn by contemporary academic disciplines. So their work is sort of hard to classify. It encompasses theology, ethics, philosophy, biblical commentary, autobiography, sermons, and even devotional literature. Bonhoeffer, even when he was in prison towards the end of his life, experimented with writing fiction. But both Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas recognized that theology is first and foremost for the building up of the church and the empowering of the church for its mission in the world. And that's similar to the comment that that Robin attributed to me about theology being practical. I don't recall that exact quote, but I can imagine saying it. So I'll take her word for it. So both Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas didn't write theology simply for academics, but also for the faithful, which gives their work a bit more of an accessible character than some academic theologians. And related to this, both Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas are eminently quotable. From Bonhoeffer, we have such famous terms that he's coined and we've heard mentioned tonight already as cheap grace, religionless Christianity, Jesus the man for others. And then some of his more extended quotations. David mentioned, when Jesus calls a man, he bids him come and die. Bonhoeffer, another one of his quotes, whoever cannot be alone should beware of community. Whoever cannot stand being in community should beware of being alone. Hauerwas, for his part, has many well-known quotes as well. His ability to turn a phrase has sometimes led people to attribute the term Hauerwasianisms to these phrases. And some of the more famous ones or memorable ones include his definition of modernity as the attempt to produce people who believe they should have no story except the story they chose for themselves when they had no story. Or the church, as we've heard several quote already, was one of his most famous Hauerwasianisms. The church does not have a social ethic. The church is a social ethic. Or his description of Christianity as an adventure we didn't know we wanted to be on. So engaging Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas proved to be very stimulating dialogue partners, particularly for addressing the question that I was interested in of what does it mean to be a Christian in our modern or postmodern world. Now, as I engaged more deeply with Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas, I came to realize that if you start with that question, you're going to get the wrong answer. That if we start with that question, the result is inevitably culturally accommodated forms of Christianity, which we see today on both the left and the right. They're both equally accommodated to our current culture. And the problem is the question isn't historically or theologically thick enough. It needs to be filled in. And so in order to fill it in, you have to ask a prior question. And that question is, what does it mean to be the church at the end of Christendom? And Robin eloquently sort of filled in some of the details surrounding this time we find ourselves in when the church has both lost and is being stripped of its various historic privileges. But this question of what does it mean to be the church in the time after Christendom in itself isn't quite theologically thick enough, because we cannot understand history or the church rightly apart from the one who is the Lord of history and the head of the church. So prior to either of those questions, we have to ask the question, who is Jesus Christ? And that explains the logic of the ordering of the chapters in the book. And Glenn was quite right in his comment. It's a logical ordering. It's not an experiential ordering. It's not that we get Jesus right first and then we move on to the project of being church. And then we get our life together sorted out and we go out into the world. We're simultaneously enmeshed and immersed in all of those realities at the same time. But it does explain the reason for ordering the book in the way I did. So chapter 2 as the three central chapters, chapter 2, 3, and 4. Chapter 2, as David rightly pointed out, I mean, the tweetable version of the chapter is, who is Jesus Christ? What is the full significance of the profession Jesus is Lord? So if Jesus is Lord, what does it mean if we prosecute that all the way down? Chapter 3... then the tweetable version would be, what if the New Testament is right and the church truly is Christ's body? And that's as Robin fleshed out for us there, what chapter 3 I think is at. And chapter 4, as the body of the risen Lord, how does the church in exile seek the peace and the prosperity of the city in which it finds itself, to quote the famous verse from Jeremiah 29. So a few brief responses to the talks we've heard, and there was so much that was rich and wonderful in those. I'm not going to be able to do them justice at all. But starting with David's talk, David, I was especially pleased David was able to join us via video. David was one of the earliest readers of a lot of this material, as it was coming off my word processor in very early drafts. David was eagerly consuming it and responding to various sections. So I was delighted that he was be able to participate with us this evening, and even more delighted to see his growth and formation from his time here at Good Shepherd to where now he is the lead pastor of a congregation in Regina. It's been a privilege to see his journey and his growth in the Lord. So thankful he was able to participate. And I think he effectively highlighted some of the major emphases of the chapters. I'm not sure I explicitly drew all the conclusions that David drew, but they seem to be fair conclusions. So I'm not going to take issue with them. David asked about how Christ is the shape of natural theology. And there's maybe a little sort of a technical question, but maybe a little background that maybe makes it a little more accessible. So natural theology is this idea, and it seems to arise in the last, it's a recent invention, in the last 200 years or so, that we can somehow figure out who God is apart from his revelation to us in the person of Jesus Christ. So if we simply observe our world and collect all the data, we can come to some understanding of who Jesus is. Now, both Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas find this problematic, and I do as well. And I would sort of summarize it in this way. I think there's two major problems with natural theology per se. There is a problem, I guess, that fails to recognize the eschatological character of the Christian faith. So in other words, natural theology reinscribes the notion that the way things are is the way that they have to be. But the gospel tells us that the way things are is not the way they are meant to be, nor that the way that they will be when the kingdom of God comes in its fullness. And for Bonhoeffer, of course, natural theology is extremely dangerous because there are German theologians saying it's immediately apparent that the German race, on the account of nature, is superior to all other races, and they should therefore exercise their privilege in taking the space, the living space, the Lebensraum that they need. So natural theology is dangerous in that regard. Also, natural theology is dangerous in the sense that it never gets us to the triune God. The God of the philosophers is not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the way I flesh this out for my students, and I have some of my best students sitting in the front row, so they've heard this before, but I enjoyed giving this example, so I will take a moment to do it here. Imagine a thought experiment with me, that I am the proud owner of a large aquarium. I'm a fish aficionado. And there's a debate going on in the aquarium about whether Rob exists. Does Rob exist or does he not? And some of the fish are convinced that Rob must exist. There's food that arrives on the surface of the water at 5 p.m. every day. There is this pirate ship that sunken pirate ship in the middle of the tank. There's these colorful rocks that appear to be organized in some type of pattern. Rob must exist. And other fish are saying, well, I don't know about that. We're not sure that Rob exists. I mean, what about Tony the Tetra? He got sucked into the filter and was brutally mangled. How could a good and loving Rob allow something like that to happen? So this debate goes on and on, and the fish are trying to determine whether Rob exists or not. And eventually, say the fish who thinks that Rob exists win the day, and all the fish come to believe that Rob exists. What do they actually know about Rob? They don't know that I'm married to Melissa. They don't know that I've written what I guess is apparently a good book. they don't know that I teach theology or that I'm a pastor. Maybe they might come to some conclusion that I like fish. but they don't know if I like fish in the sense that I like watching them swim and thrive, or I like fish lightly battered and fried up in butter. Natural theology does not get us to where we need to go, which is the God who is for us and with us eternally in the person of Jesus Christ and the power of the Spirit. So what would a natural theology look like then? I mean, Glenn sort of got at some of that, and I think in the last chapter sort of fleshes that out a little bit. We understand the created order through the person of Christ, and Christ allows us to enter fully into our humanity, to be the truly human creatures that we were created to be. And there's a lot more fleshing out that could be done for sure on that, but that would be sort of in the direction I'd want to go. For Robin's talk, I'm not sure I'd want to say much more other than I hope I was saying what Robin said I was saying. And Robin was one of my best students, and that was, I think, probably clear in the talk there tonight. And fortunately, I'm not going to say the best student, because there's about half a dozen of my best students here tonight. But it does remind me of something that Howard Wass is fond of saying. At the start of his classes at Duke, he tells his students that his job as a teacher is not to help his students learn to make up their own minds. Instead, he says, he tells them that he does not believe that they have minds worth making up until they have been trained by me. So I have done well. But, I mean, there's a deeper theological point that Howard Wass is getting at there, too. In our modern culture, we're trained to think that we all have to learn to think for ourselves. But biblically speaking, until the mind of Christ is formed within us, we actually don't have minds worth making up. So to whatever extent, and I can't claim a great extent for whatever extent I have been an instrument in the Lord's forming of the mind of Christ in Robin, then I am thankful for that. Glenn, who looked at the final topic, final chapter, I realized this afternoon the last chapter, the last major chapter, deals at one point with one of Bonhoeffer's famous theological themes, where he speaks about how the incarnation of the reality of Christ allows us to enter into all of the dimensions of life at the same time. And he draws upon a musical metaphor, the polyphony of life. And Glenn didn't even mention it. this afternoon I was thinking, it wasn't on my radar when I assigned you the chapter, Glenn, but I was thinking this afternoon, what a cliche that I've asked the musician to do the chapter that deals with the polyphony of life. So thank you for not succumbing to the cliche. But I thought that it was a beautiful set of reflections on your deeply rooted in your context and in your striving to be the type of missional community that God is calling you to be. I really was drawn to your community's practice of the sacrament of the ordinary. That seemed to be a wonderful practice that resonates with some of the things I do in the book. And also, I mean, the several of my former in-ministry students here as well have studied Dorothy Day with me as well, the founder of the Catholic Worker. And she has this wonderful turn of phrase where she talks about the sacrament of the present moment. And I could see that resonating as well. And that if I had the opportunity, that would be something I'd be interested in exploring further. And the tables, I think, was helpful in that the table of the Lord does open up to encompass or direct us towards the tables in our homes and the tables in the world. I mean, in a similar way, I think it was Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, talked about the world being in the wafer. Now, we don't use wafers here at Good Shepherd, but the world in the loaf, maybe. The analogy is still apropos. I'm glad you talked about the section on friendship. That's probably my favorite part of the book, particularly the section on Jean Vanier, becoming friends of time. That is, if you're allowed to have a favorite part of your book, that's probably my favorite part. Going back, jumping around a little bit here, but connected with the table. I mean, this very space that the community gathers in for worship, particularly this space where we have trees growing, we have ferns, we could turn on the fountain and we see running water. As we gather here for worship, it should be training us to go out and see the sacramentality of God's creation, to enter into the sacrament of the ordinary. And, I mean, for Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas, I mean, another theme is that as we go, we encounter Christ out there in the face of the stranger. But it's only through the formation that we have received in learning to worship God, in learning to break bread at his table, that we are then, our eyes are open to recognize his presence elsewhere, in the poor, in the needy, in the least, the last, and the lost. The kingdom of God, you mentioned, Glenn, the kingdom of God is a major theme for Hauerwas. Hauerwas doesn't explicitly feature so prominently in Bonhoeffer, because I think there is some, between the time Bonhoeffer is working in Germany in the 30s and 40s and Hauerwas is working in the 80s and 90s, there's been work in biblical studies that has really recovered the centrality of the kingdom to Jesus' proclamation and mission. But the kingdom is central for Hauerwas. But he is concerned, he wants to distance himself from the social gospel movement that also had made the kingdom of God a major focus. But in Hauerwas' estimation, the social gospel movement had confused the kingdom of God with America. So he wants to distance himself from that regard, but still wants to speak of the kingdom of God as the reign of Christ. And that reign takes the form of a particular politics, and that politics is the people who have learned to speak truthfully to one another as they've been made worshippers of the triune God. There's much more I could say in response to David and Robin and Glenn, but those were very rich reflections. And so as I joked at the beginning there, I hope what they've picked up is there in the book. And it is as good as they've given the impression that it is. Writing a book is, I think, in some ways like giving birth. And Melissa happened to walk by the computer as I wrote this line, and she said, "You have no idea what it's like to give birth. It's nothing like writing a book." But humor me and imagine that writing a book is in some ways like giving birth. There's this period of conception and gestation, and it develops, and eventually then it comes to birth, and it's out there. The difference, though, is giving birth, you have this child who then is under your protection and nurture and care for several years. And they're gradually developing their own personal unique character, and then at some point you send them off to school or they leave home. But a book, you don't have that opportunity. It's just, you have the conception and gestation and development, but then it just arrives and it's out there. So in some ways, I think Robin and Glenn and David, you've sort of provided a little bit of that, a gentle welcoming into the world for this book, maybe a type of infancy or adolescence for the book before it goes out and reaches maybe less sympathetic eyes or minds or hearts. A few brief tips for reading, maybe. I mean, it is a revised version of an academic dissertation. So at points there is some heavy theological lifting that goes on, and even at some of those points maybe a theological dictionary could be helpful. But Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas do have a gift for writing theology which is accessible to the whole church. So that does, I think, make their theology reasonably accessible to those who are interested. And you'll have to tell me whether I too have have that gift or not. But I am pleased to say that I've recently signed a contract for another book, a more popular book. So there will be a more popular book coming that will feature some of the sermons that I've preached here at Good Shepherd. And I see there's representatives here tonight of other congregations, Bridalwood, Nashville, that I have done some significant ministry in. And so this I'm excited about that appearing, and also to have one of my preaching heroes, Fleming Rutledge, contributing a foreword. So look for that at the end of the year, maybe in the new year. This book, I think you can either read it like a book, cover to cover. If you're really interested in Bonhoeffer, each of the chapters is a major section on Bonhoeffer. You could just read the Bonhoeffer parts. If you're interested in Hauerwas, you could just read the Hauerwas parts. If you're interested in Dean, as David kept saying there, Bonhoeffer, Hauerwas, and Dean, you could read the summary sections where I'm doing some of my more creative theological work. It's also an appendix, which I felt I had to include because the recurring question that I'm asked often when people find out that I've written about Bonhoeffer is, what do you make of Bonhoeffer's decision to participate in a plot to assassinate Hitler? And especially when you're writing a book on Bonhoeffer and Hauerwas, who is perhaps the preeminent advocate of pacifism, theological pacifism, you've got to deal with that question. So the appendix is where I try to get at that. And it's also somewhat timely, I think, in that Bonhoeffer is often misappropriated. People who read very little Bonhoeffer or have very little understanding of him want to say, Bonhoeffer participated in a plot to kill Hitler, therefore I may blow up an abortion clinic, or therefore I may assassinate Hugo Chavez, or therefore I may preemptively invade Iraq, or most recently, therefore we must all vote for Donald Trump if we are going to ensure the success and greatness of our nation. So the appendix has proved to be timely in a way that I could never have anticipated when I originally wrote it. So thanks again to our responders, and thank you all for coming out and supporting me tonight and in the various ways you've supported me throughout the project. So thank you, and go in peace, but don't go in peace too quickly.